We are here with the one and only Keith Richards. Good day to you, sir.
Hi, Pierre. How you doing?
I'm just doing great. And seeing you is making me feel even better.
Good. That's what we're here for.
Cool. We're here to talk about Exile on Main Street. And in one interview I read, what Exile did, this is a quote of yours, what Exile did was keep growing until it made its mark over a period of time. It just seeped in.
Yeah, it did. I always had a feeling about that album was going to stick around. I didn't imagine 40 years. if I'd have known how long Main Street was, you know, I don't know if I'd have made it.
Now, what everybody also says is this is Keith's record. Mm. What goes through your head when you hear a comment like that?
I can understand. And on listening to it, I can understand why people think so. I did put a lot of stuff in there, and I had pretty much free rein. But what I really have to say is that it's only other people that have that impression. From my point of view, it's a Rolling Stones record, and it's a team job. I mean, I remember us all down there doing it, and I mean, I can understand it in a way, maybe for the fact that it was my house and I was living on top of it. So I was sort of had my stamp on it from dawn to dusk, you know. And in that way, I can understand it. But really, it was, as usual, a great teamwork, good group job, you know.
The place you rented is called Villa Nelcott, in the south of France, in Villefranche, in fact. Do you have memories even this far back of that house?
Yeah, it was an incredible house. It just by itself, as a villa in the south of France, beautiful gardens, its own jetty, which I had a speedboat. We used to use that quite a lot.
You had an old Italian wooden Riva, I believe.
Riva. We used to go down to Monte Carlo or Italy for breakfast once we got out of the basement.
In fact, some of the people were saying, don't let your kids get in the boat while Keith's driving.
We made it. We didn't sink.
I heard that the house was actually Gestapo headquarters during World War II, and that in the basement one could actually, in some of the heater vents, find swastikas. Is that true, or is that just a myth?
It's true that it was the old chap's HQ, the boys in black.
The old chaps.
And there was something about the staircase, too, which, although not overtly so, was very much a swastika design. But that could just be coincidence. I mean, we didn't see any chains hanging from the walls. There was no rack down there. It disappointed me.
You said Exile is the first grunge record. What do you mean by that?
I don't know if I said it, but probably because of the... the conditions we were working in,
Well, speaking of the conditions you were working in, Bill Wyman has a recollection of trying to do overdubs in the basement, and he says at the same time, dogs were barking, kids were playing, people were eating, knives and forks were clanking about together. There were goats and animals. It was a complete menagerie. And the more I read about the situation there, not having been there, obviously, it occurred to me that this might be the real life come-to-life realization of the inside sleeve of Beggar's Banquet, which has all the Rolling Stones around this huge banquet table, and there are dogs and goats and kids and drink and smoke and food and everything. Is that a fair comparison?
Yes, it's a very good one, actually. Yeah. It was like that without the tights.
With the events and the decadence that took place there, has it ever crossed your mind that you don't live like a normal person?
Has it ever occurred to you that you're talking to an absolute maniac? I mean, I've been doing this since I was 19, and I know no other life. I'm a total nomad, and actually, it was a very, very gypsy-like atmosphere at Nelcott in that summer. People passing through. Friends of friends. But it was all going on upstairs, it was on another level, because actually you can't write songs in the afternoon, feed them to a hungry band in the evening and try and make a record and still have time for debauching. It can't be done. Even Keith Richards can't do that,
You have to sleep sometime. What did your neighbors think of you? Did you ever invite them over for tea?
They were far enough away to be absolutely invisible.
I want to talk about Following the River, which is one of the songs in which Mick sings, "My cards are on the table, but the drinks have all run out." And then the beautiful chorus comes into that song. There are new vocals on it and a few added parts, but tell us about that song.
You know, when I hear it now, I wonder why we left it off. But I think it was because it wasn't finished at the time, and also we had to cram as much as we could because we wanted it to be a double album. I don't know why Mick and I insisted so much, but I think we just had a feeling that somehow it dimly penetrated us that there was something more to this record than that you can't play around with it, you know. And we tried to make a single record out of it because the record companies really didn't want a double, you know. We tried every which way to make a single, and it just sounded like emasculated, you know. I mean, where's the head? I don't know. Oh, we had to cut that off, you know. And so we had a big fight with the record company about it being a double, which from their point of view, I mean, just purely commercial, you know, was, you know, they first off, double albums more expensive. They don't sell as much as single albums. And so we had to weigh all of that in before we decided. So, no, we just cannot cut this baby in half, you know. And so things like going to the river went to the wall. You know. It was hard enough getting those 18 tracks on.
Not to mention the 10 that are on the re-release.
Yeah,
And Don Was says there's another 30 that are bits and pieces that are still in the vaults.
Whenever you make a record, there's always... I mean, what the record is actually the tip of an iceberg, and what doesn't come out is whole loads of stuff which is promising, or it's a germ of an idea. It goes through grades, the stuff you leave behind. And usually you pick up on the next record, you know. But the next record we cut was in Jamaica, and
Goat's Head Soup.
Goat's Head, yeah. And we weren't getting around to listening to outtakes from Exile, you know. So we just sort of ploughed on ahead, and all these things got left behind.
But the Stones have had great history, though, with finding things that were in the vaults. I believe Start Me Up, it was 5 or 6 years
old. Yes, yeah.
As was Waiting on a Friend, right?
Yeah, they were both around for a while. You can't... I mean, sometimes you lay down a song and... It's right, but maybe, you know, somebody else, you've got another riff in your mind, and so you kind of leave that, and sometimes you can totally forget it. That happened with Waiting on a Friend for quite a while, yeah. And Start Me Up, I mean, sometimes you just get, you know, I don't know, tunnel vision or something, something goes by you, and you don't get it. But that's why we keep the can, you know.
Right. I want to talk about the contributions of Mick Taylor for a second. Marshall Chess, who was the first president of Rolling Stone Records, said in a quote, "I loved the play between Keith and Mick Taylor because Mick Taylor, was so melodic and Keith so rhythmic. That's what made them a great band, that they were both playing different styles that meshed." Would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Marshall hit it on the head. Working with Mick, I mean, I got to say, I never understood why he left, you know. I mean, melodic is the word. I mean, Marshall hit it there. And so when we started to work together, I figured I've got to let this guy have his own space, you know. Whereas working with Brian, we used to cram guitars together, you know, more weaving, and there was no particular lead or rhythm. You both took over. And so working with Mick, you have to just develop a different way of playing. I mean, it's not really that hard to do. It's a few sessions of getting to know how the guy plays, and it's pretty simple. And I felt that what I've got to do with Mick Taylor is to lay down the solid rhythm, and just let the man fly on the top, you know. So there's a little more space in the guitar sounds with Mick Taylor, but lovely player.
You said about Villa Nilcott, upstairs it was like the palace at Versailles, but downstairs the basement was like Dante's Inferno.
Yeah, that's about it, yeah.
And I understood that the heat and the humidity was such that the guitars would go out of tune halfway through a song, is that right?
Yeah, sometimes they would. You had to sort of... And by then we were starting to like the sound we were getting out of this place. But when they suggested finally, they said they thought they'd found a studio that would, now we could move. And we all looked at each other and said, no, we don't want to go now. The basement was... it was the strangest place to sort of go to work. You know, I'm going to work, you know, and boom, 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 and down into the Hitler's bunker.
Can you talk about Jimmy Miller, who was your longtime producer a number of albums before that, and a percussionist in his own right, and his contribution to this?
Jimmy was an amazing producer, especially for the Stones. He was basically the proverbial sixth Stone at that point. I think it's important for the Stones to have a producer that that is a musician as well, and Jimmy was a musician. And it's the same thing I would say about Don was. Don had been a great musician. We work better with producers that know how it's done, rather than there are other producers. That sort of they have a vision and stuff, but you can never quite understand what it is. And it's easier to communicate through music. But Jimmy Miller was, I think, one of the best producers ever, anyway, no matter what he did. And for the band, he had a great feel for the band. And I say he was treated like one of the bands.
Well, the song Happy is such a marvelous tune.
Yeah.
And it happened with just him and Bobby Keys on the sax. And Bobby Keys said in a hysterical quote, he said regarding Happy, quote, it was about as unrehearsed as a hiccup.
True.
Was it just the afternoon and you said, let's go try this out?
I'd finished a couple of songs off, so I knew that I had something in the magazine to give the guys in the evening. And it was still early afternoon. I went down there and I just hit these first two chords on the five string. And before I knew it, this song is sort of writing itself in front of me. I'm just standing in front of the microphone going, never care to dial up. Write it down. I said, I don't have time, I'm too busy. And it was all just coming. And so I'm going, well, that's pretty good, leave that. So just to memorize it. And so do it one more time. Okay. So I start to play it again. And suddenly I hear this baritone sax creeping in. And I can't see from where, I'm too busy working. And it sounded great. And then halfway through, suddenly these drums start kicking in. And I go, wow, everything's happening to me today, And the words are coming, the song is coming. And the band has arrived. And it was just Bobby and Jimmy came down and just had to have some fun,
The song has been compared to Cole Porter's I Get a Kick Out of You, and I've heard that there are bootleg tapes of you actually playing I Get a Kick Out of You
somewhere. Oh, yeah, there would be. Yeah, I've no doubt there is. It's a favorite little guitar exercise of mine. I play it a lot different from Cole Porter, though.
How did Happy go down on the 72 tour?
Well, it was a new song then. It's always gone down well. I think it's just the title, really. It'd be a pretty sore bastard to be sitting there going boo and somebody singing Happy.
That is so cool. There are so many unreleased songs from this era. It makes me wonder how many other albums, and you've had so many great and colorful records, that there are unreleased material from. Would you see this process going on in the future?
Yeah, I think as we speak, after this Exile thing, I think people are rummaging through the can as we speak, man.
In terms of your and Mick's relationship and your songwriting style, it's entirely different, but sometimes there's a passive-aggressive nature that's been a part of that. How do you deal with it when you have a difference?
Well, I think it's not so much a difference as a balance. Huh. There are certainly different, two different peas, not from the same part. But I think it is exactly the chemistry between Mick and me, that we're not on totally the same level. Otherwise, you get no movement. I think it's the matter of the balance or imbalance, if you like, that and trying to find a balance, which we always do. But we work a lot apart because we don't see each other a lot when we're not working. So really, it's quite interesting when we do get together. got any songs? You know, come on, show us one, you know.
Well, there's a great story on Rocks Off on the record where Andy Johns, you guys had worked till 5 in the morning. Andy Johns drives his half an hour to the place he's staying at. He's the recording engineer.
Yeah.
He sees that you've crashed, and he figures the session's over. He gets there only to get a phone call from you saying, "Where the hell are you? Get back here." And you had a part that you needed to add to Rocks Off. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, everybody's on call, you know, when we're making records.
Andy Johns said, thank God he did that, because whatever part you put on it, you know, was brilliant.
Yeah, I can't remember the exact day, but I mean, I remember the feeling of turning around saying, I've got to put this part on right now. Andy? No reply, you know. Andy, oh, he's gone home. Gone home, you know. I mean, where's the f***ing phone?
In the deluxe package of this re-release, there's going to be some footage from the 72 tour, the Exile tour, and I saw a scene of it where you were in your hotel room and you actually walk out on the balcony with a television set and throw it over the edge.
With Bobby Keys.
Yeah. With Bobby Keys, who was quite the troublemaker anyway. I don't know if that was an early premonition of what would come with the Baboon Cage later on in the years on tour with you guys.
Well, yeah, who knows? I mean, that's when you know you got road fever, when you start throwing TVs out of the window just for fun. You know, well, how long we've been working, Bobby? You know, like, oh, it's about a year and a half now. No, okay, time to throw a TV.
Did you ever hang with Keith Moon or John Bonham? Because you seem cut from a similar cloth.
John Bonham, no, I barely knew. Keith Moon, I knew Mooney pretty well. Yeah, yeah, he's a nut.
Yeah,
the world's a better off place without him. You know, sorry, Keith.
The last time that you and I spoke, you brought up a point which I have thought of ever since, which is we were talking at the time about Out of Control, which was on, I think, Bridges to Babylon, and how much better I thought it sounded on the live version, No Security. And you can reference a lot of songs here on the re-releases. You can see their earlier versions, Loving Cup and Tumbling Dice, and see how they grow. But your point was, you have to remember that when you get in the studio and you make the song, that's the first the band even knows it.
Exactly.
And then it has this whole life outside of that.
Yeah.
And like it, with Loving Cup, a great example of that is having been written all that time ago, but a couple of years ago here in New York, you guys played The Beacon, and Jack White came out and sang that song, and it had grown. It had taken on this other life, and it's a really cool point that I think a lot of people miss.
Things grow, you know, like Exile. I mean, I never expected to be at the Museum of Modern Art. I thought to myself, the record, well, come a long way, boy.
There was one point where Mick, you once said, was kind of afraid that the Rolling Stones might turn into some kind of nostalgia. But you said in a quote, "I see the Rolling Stones on the cutting edge of growing this music up." And I think that really plays into the last thing we were just talking about. Because when you see this band live, you haven't toured for a couple of years, but I am floored by how you're able to make even a 30-year-old song sound like it came off the presses that moment. It's that fresh. It's that vital. There's no going through the motions, in other words.
I get you. You know, songs are amazing things. To me, I really sort of don't even like them to call it, say, I wrote this, I created this, because I really feel like you're more of a transmitter than anything. Songs... Quite honestly, there's songs zooming through this room right now. All you've got to do is catch them, you know. And so what I do is sit down at a piano or pick up a guitar and, hey, play some Buddy Holly songs or whatever, you know, Otis Redding on piano. And then after about 20 minutes, if you get lucky, suddenly something starts to drift in on its own, you know, that you didn't intend. And that's when you know that incoming... And you grab hold of that little tail and start, and suddenly there's a song before your eyes. To me, it's a miracle. You know, I mean, I don't slave at this. I sit and watch it and wonder, you know. And all I do, there it is, and I polish it a bit, you know, make it look, you know, fit for human consumption. And then I transmit it. Off you go. You know, and if that's the sort of timeless thing about it, you know,
Even Satisfaction came to you that way, didn't it? Like in a hotel room
one
night.
Dream, yeah. I was actually it was in my apartment. I had a brand new high tech those days cassette player. They were only just coming on the market. You know. I put in a fresh tape, just in case. And next to the bed, there, I put the guitar at the foot of the bed, and I say, right, I'm going to go to sleep. When I wake up the next morning, I just happen to glance at the cassette. And it's run all the way to the end. Maybe I, you know, put my hand out in the night and hit the fast forward or something. And then I notice that the guitar is now next to me, and it's got it. I'm sleeping with my guitar now, and so I push rewind all the way back. And there enough, there's. I can't get no satisfaction. The song, whole verse. Except at the end, it was, and I tried, and I tried, and I tried. And the whole tape is me snoring. Apart from that, you know.
Oh, that's priceless.
Thank God for that little recorder.
You might not have even remembered it otherwise.
No.
Wow. Are you dying to go out on tour?
I'd like to get back to work, yeah. I mean, doing this has been a sort of retro year doing XI, and as fun as it's been, I want to get forward, you know.
All right. Will the band tour? Are there plans?
I was just talking to Charlie about it just now, and we were just sort of kicking around ideas, and he says, yeah, I'd really want to. He says, and I said to him, yeah, but it's a matter of how. And what we've got to do is, I mean, we can't go out on those extravaganzas again with, you know, the tights. we've got to find another way of being the Rolling Stones. We've got to grow the mothers up. You know?
Well, you could do residencies, it occurred to me. You know, you could pick
major
cities. Yeah,
there's loads of ideas floating around.
You know, go to London for 20 nights, go to New York for 20 nights. I'm from Philly, so I'd have to say come to Philly for 20 nights, things like that. There was a great interview, Keith, a couple of years ago, maybe about a year ago now, and I saved it because I thought it was brilliant. These days, what we hear everyone say is, as a compliment, kids will say it to each other, musicians will say it to each other, hey, that was great, you rock. Yeah, no, you rock. No, you rock. And you said, you know what? I missed the role.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been my bee in my bonnet. What happened to the role? And it, rock, yeah, you know, it's, but that's the easy part. You know, I mean, it's the role that counts. It should swing, and they should have a certain movement about it, rather than so I got pissed off with this rock, that rock, you rock. You know.
Do your kids say you rock, or do they even say that phrase?
They've been brought up properly. They say, Dad, you rock and roll.
Another thing I wanted to ask you about is your health, because we heard the tree incident down in the islands, and you got back on tour right after that, and you're sitting here before me, and I think you look better than ever. What is the state of your health these days?
Well, the proof is in the pudding. I don't think about it. I'm fine.
I was talking to a friend of mine, and he said, you know what Keith ought to do? I said, what? He said, he ought to put out a fitness video.
That's what my doctors said.
Really?
Yeah. They're all amazed on me. Yeah. They want me to leave my body to science. But I'm afraid I'll turn them down.
Think about it, a Keith Richards fitness video, because you've beaten all the odds on every level of measuring
what would you
odds.
Get? You'd get a screen full of me lying around on the couch, you know, maybe strumming a guitar or not. Maybe cook my own breakfast if nobody's around. Take the dog out for a walk. Go back to the couch. I mean, there's not a lot to it. I mean, really. I mean, I'd sell this to a few guys, you know. Show you how it's done.
In your portion of the show over the past couple of tours, you open it, no matter what town you were in, and I've seen you in a number of them, and you come to the microphone for your songs, and you go, ladies and gentlemen, good to be here. And you, a dramatic pause, and then you say, it's good to be anywhere. And I don't know if you know this, but George Burns, a legendary comedian, used to say that as well.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Maybe that's where I got it from. You know, I mean, I remember, I've got a very good memory, and I love George Burns, actually. Yeah.
In terms of how you approach the future, where do you think the band is going?
Well, it's definitely going forward. In what direction, I'm not sure yet. I mean, First time the three of us have seen each other together, probably since the end of the tour. I've seen Mick and I've seen Charlie. But so I'm hoping, and don't tell anybody, I'm hoping while they're here together to sort of get some concrete answer to that question. But right now I can't say.
Okay. You know? There was a gentleman who hung out at Nelcott that summer. His name was Tommy Weber. And he had the most beautiful thing about you that he said in a quote I'd like to read to you. He said about Keith, "The guy is a real gent. His idea of behaving well is what we would call forgiveness. It's absolutely amazing the understanding that he carries about in his whole demeanor. Really, popes should be like that." Popes should be like that. I don't know that I've ever heard you compared to a pope before.
I don't think I'd wear that rig.
But people have said that you don't carry grudges and that you really regard people with great affinity and, you know, you exude a lot of love. And that might be how you survive and carry on and stay so healthy.
Maybe it is. Maybe I don't even want to know what it is as long as it's there.
Regarding the songwriting between you and Mick, you said, "I can't sit around on a song too long. I like to get in the studio and write it there." Mick, however, likes to have it all worked out and rehearsed before he goes in. That's the basic difference between us. I get bored quicker. Mix rock, I'm roll.
Yeah, maybe so. Yeah, I'll stand by that. But, that's another one of the differences as we were talking about earlier between Mick and me, that balance. Mick likes to prepare everything. He likes to... I like to be basically unprepared. I want to be caught by surprise when I'm in the studio. I want to not know everything that I'm doing, because then, to me, the way I work, I find other things that are better than if I'd have sat around. And it saves a lot of paper.
Is there a favorite song from Exile that you have?
Oh, that's a rough one. It's always hard to pick one. I do love Tumbling Dice. Absolutely. I'm happy too. Then I can go on and on. You know,
Torn and Frayed. I just love, yeah. Torn and Frayed.
I like that one too.
And Shine a Light. Taj Mahal was on TV the other night on Jimmy Fallon.
I saw him last night.
Was there last night. And Jimmy Fallon this week has been doing a series on Exile on Main Street, mm-hmm. on his late show. And on Monday he had on Green Day,
yeah.
who did a brilliant version of Rip This Joint. I mean, they nailed it.
They were doing it. Yeah, it came up. Yeah.
Oh, you got to see it. It's just so cool. And then last night he had Keith Urban on doing Tumbling Dice, actually. And on Monday night he also had Taj Mahal doing Shine a Light, and a really beautiful version. Would you say on this album it's fair to say the horns were one of the stars? Because the horns have such a dramatic role in almost every song. The horns and the gospel singers.
Yeah, there was. I mean, we integrated the horns into the band, the sound of the band, on that album, far more than we had previously. We'd used Bobby and Jim on Sticky Fingers and as well, but it was only just on a few tracks. In Exile, I think you have the... It was a band. They were part of the band by then. You know, I mean, it was a very good unit. You know, despite all of the heat and the dust and everything, you know, it really, once you get in that groove, all of those things are peripheral. You know, it doesn't matter. I didn't even know there were cameras around until I saw that movie. You know, Charlie, I said, "Do you remember anybody shooting?" "No, because you're in another zone." You know,
Keith, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Okay, my pleasure, Pierre.
Great to see you again.
You too, mate.